From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's program, NSA reform bills fight it out on Capitol Hill as John Kerry offers his take.
There was news in the papers of 70 million people being listened to. No, they weren't. It didn't happen. There's an enormous amount of exaggeration and misreporting in some of what is out there.
We talked to our reporter in Nigeria on the government's battle with brutal Boko Haram extremists. It's been a busy week for whistleblower Edward Snowden. We get all the details from Moscow. And also on today's show, the inspiring story of Haitian competitors running this weekend's New York Marathon to help their homeland.
I feel confident coming into this competition. I'm already used to participating in marathon competitions, so I remain focused, calm, and relaxed.
That's coming up on FSN Reports, after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The leader of the Pakistan Taliban has been killed in a U.S. drone strike. Hakimullah Massoud was one of the world's most wanted men, with a $5 million bounty on his head. Nick Harper reports from New York.
Hakimullah Massoud is said to have been killed along with two of his bodyguards when the car he was travelling in was hit by four missiles in the Pakistani area of North Waziristan. As the Pakistani Taliban leader, it's believed he was responsible for the death of thousands of people as a result of bomb and gun attacks across the country. He took over the position in 2009 after the former commander was similarly killed by a US drone strike. The use of the unmanned aircraft by America to target militants has been heavily criticized by Pakistan, who feel they undermine the country's sovereignty. Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, recently in Washington, D.C. for talks with U.S. President Barack Obama, has repeatedly called for an end to the drone strikes.
A shooting incident at Los Angeles International Airport caused multiple injuries and left a TSA agent dead. Authorities say the suspect is now in custody. Flights were grounded and thousands of passengers evacuated. A man armed with an assault rifle is reported to have started arguing with security officers at a checkpoint. Witnesses describe how the violence suddenly erupted in LAX.
We heard the pop, 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 at least one of them. And then we dove down and little did I know, I looked to the side and this guy is going up the stairs with the rifle. He's just shooting.
We were just going through TSA. We had our belongings on the belt, ready to be scanned. And we heard about eight gunshots that were fired right down at the bottom of the escalator from where we were at.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has conceded the U.S. may have gone too far in spying on its allies. In a bid to mend fences with European nations, America's top diplomat admitted Washington has crossed some lines, but defended its secret surveillance programs. From Washington, Nina Maria Potts reports.
Speaking via video link from Washington, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told the Open Government Partnership Summit in London on Thursday that the National Security Agency's intelligence gathering was essential to fighting terrorism. But he did concede that in some cases the U.S. had gone too far.
In some cases, I acknowledge to you, as has the President, some of these actions have reached too far, and we are going to make sure that that does not happen in the future.
Revelations the U.S. has been secretly spying on citizens and their leaders have caused international outrage. John Kerry's comments come amid protests from Asian countries over claims Australian embassies in the region were also involved in U.S.-led spying operations.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The British government says it will protest to Spanish authorities at the highest level after an armed standoff in Gibraltarian territorial waters. The Ministry of Defense said a Guardia civil patrol boat maneuvered in a provocative and dangerous manner in the vicinity of Royal Navy vessels. Our UK correspondent Dan Whitehead has more.
No shots were fired during the incident, but there was a minor collision between the Spanish vessel and a Gibraltar Defense police boat. The incident happened on Wednesday while a Gibraltar squadron boat was providing protection to a Royal Navy fleet auxiliary tanker. The Gibraltar Chronicle claims a Spanish patrol boat sailed too close to the Royal Navy vessel, breaching a security cordon off the British territory. The Spanish vessel reportedly ignored warnings from armed crew members to leave the area, resulting in a standoff.
And millions of Americans using food stamps will need to get by on less help from the government from this Friday onwards. It comes after cuts to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, comes into effect. because a temporary boost for the scheme has come to an end without a new budget from a deadlocked Congress to replace it. Lorna Shattuck reports from Washington.
Under the SNAP scheme, a family of four who previously received $668 a month in benefits will find that amount cut by $36. Vulnerable populations are likely to be hit hardest. One think tank, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, estimates that over 1 million elderly and disabled people will feel the impact. SNAP's administered by the Department of Agriculture and is authorised in a 5-year farm bill that covers all agricultural programmes. Negotiations on a new farm bill began on Wednesday. At the moment, both House and Senate versions of the legislation would still see spending reductions on SNAP. The Democrat-controlled Senate is calling for a $4 billion cut, while the Republican-controlled House wants to go further and take $39 billion out of the scheme over the next decade.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Now, as the NSA spy claims continue to mount, Secretary of State John Kerry defended the US surveillance program while admitting that it sometimes casts too wide a net.
In some cases, I acknowledge to you, as has the president, some of these actions have reached too far, and we are going to make sure that that does not happen in the future.
And in the wake of still more revelations about the scope and power of the US government spying programs, including surveillance of international banks and the United Nations, competing bills are making their way through Congress to institute reforms. The USA Freedom Act, which would end the bulk collection of domestic phone records, among other provisions, has the backing of many pro-privacy groups. But several powerful senators are backing a different bill, which activists say would codify, not curtail, the mass surveillance practices. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein has more.
Multi-hour closed-door meeting this week. The Senate Judiciary Committee passed the FISA Improvements Act 11-4. Drafted and promoted by California Democrat Dianne Feinstein, the bill would make intelligence agencies disclose some new information about their activities to the public, but it would largely give them license to continue monitoring the communications of U.S. citizens and foreign nationals, leading many civil liberties groups to oppose it.
The legalization of constitutionally offensive government powers is precisely the path to tyranny that the founders of our country tried to stop.
That's constitutional lawyer Shahid Buttar with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. He said he's especially concerned with provisions in the bill that authorize the NSA to continue collecting the so-called metadata of nearly all phone calls, essentially who Americans are calling, when, and for how long. The bill also expands the agency's power to track the cell phones of foreign nationals who enter the United States for up to 72 hours without a warrant. Documents leaked by intelligence contractor Edward Snowden showed the NSA has already been doing this in violation of its own privacy rules.
What the Feinstein bill would do is further insulate the pieces of the programs that have been most politically controversial by essentially shoring up the legal basis for those programs to operate. And people have to remember here, I think, in observing this, that there's a difference between a law and the Constitution.
Buttar and many other privacy advocates are calling for the passage of a different bill introduced this week called the USA Freedom Act. Among other provisions, the bill would completely end the NSA's bulk phone record collection, create an independent civil liberties advocate for the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and declassify key legal interpretations currently kept secret. It was introduced by Wisconsin Republican Jim Sensenbrenner in the House and Vermont Democrat Patrick Leahy in the Senate, and enjoys support from many key players on both sides of the aisle. But while support for reform cuts across party lines, so does the opposition to reining in the NSA. At a hearing this week in the House of Representatives, several top Democrats and Republicans aggressively defended the agency's practice of collecting the call records of millions of Americans. They said the program helps the government, quote, connect the dots to foil terrorist plots, and warned them that ending the surveillance would, quote, make it easier to be a terrorist. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, a key witness at the hearing, agreed and asked the committee not to take away his agency's right to continue this spying.
We also have to remain mindful of the potential negative long-term impact of overcorrecting the authorizations granted to the intelligence community. As Americans, we face an unending array of threats to our way of life, more than I've seen across in my 50 years in intelligence. And we need to sustain our ability to detect these threats.
Several major tech corporations, including Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Yahoo, Apple, and AOL, are supporting the USA Freedom Act, especially provisions that would allow them to disclose to their users how many government requests for personal data they receive. Snowden's documents revealed that some of these companies have actively collaborated with the NSA in the past, but Buttar believes the cost of doing so has started to outweigh the benefit.
Some very substantial percentage of the NSA's budget is ultimately paid out to private contractors like telecom companies that turn over records about their customers' use of their services. And that can be a cash cow for these companies, but I think a lot of them are catching on that their real interest lies in ensuring that the government does not undermine those securities.
The introduction of both reform bills came amidst new revelations about the U.S. government's previously secret surveillance activities. Citing anonymous government officials, Reuters reported this week that President Obama recently ordered the NSA to stop monitoring the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the United Nations headquarters in New York within the last few weeks. The officials did not say how long the surveillance has been going on, or whether the purpose of the spying was national security or gaining a political and economic advantage over other countries. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
And staying with the NSA story, former employee turned whistleblower Edward Snowden has been making headlines again this week, but not through his absence. He's reportedly been spotted on a boat in Moscow, has been speaking to a German MP, and may now have a job in Russia. Nina Maria Pott spoke to our Moscow correspondent Tom Barton to find out what the so-called super leaker has been up to.
Yes, it was the first meeting he's had that we know about with any foreign politician since he sort of went to ground back in the summer. Hans Christian Strobeler is a maverick German MP, but he sits on Germany's control committee, which looks at the activities of intelligence organisations. And in that meeting, Snowden did say that he would be willing to go to Germany in person and testify as part of an investigation into surveillance, which has been revealed in the past few days by the US on Chancellor Angela Merkel. That surveillance alleged, and Snowden saying he can help, that he has a lot of details, says Mr. Strobeler. Of course, conditions under which Snowden would be able to do that have to be further established, says the MP. Would indeed, though, he be allowed to go to Germany? Vladimir Putin himself, an ex-KGB spy, said that he would only give asylum to Mr. Snowden if he didn't cause further harm to the US. And there always has been a lot of damage done to US-Russia relations by these revelations and by Russia's repeated refusal to extradite Snowden, where he faces espionage charges in the US. So the question begs, what would the US think of Germany and how might it respond if Snowden went there?
Well, he's already apparently got a suitably computer-oriented job. What is it?
It's a website maintenance job at one of the large internet companies in Russia. We still don't know exactly where, although two of them, Mail.ru and Yandex, have categorically denied that they've hired him. Another, VKontakte, previously made a job offer to Snowden. They refused to confirm or deny it, so there's much speculation that that is now where he's working.
Well, that's very interesting. It seems Snowden is finally coming out of hiding. Have the media actually seen him yet?
We've seen a picture of him with this German MP, and we've also seen a picture of him just recently in on a Russian tabloid news website, where it is certainly a very surprising likeness of him, if it isn't him, on the Moscow River taking a boat trip. He's got a cap on, and another photo of him and some video meeting former US secret agents to receive an award in October. Apart from that, that is it at the moment. That's all we have seen of him. He's not said anything to the media directly yet, and we still have no location as to where he is. He will probably, despite these latest revelations, want to remain out of the spotlight, as he is still a wanted man in the US on those espionage charges.
Northeastern Nigeria is under a state of emergency as the extremist group Boko Haram attempts to establish an Islamic state. Violent attacks by the group in northern Nigeria have been consistent and brutal in recent weeks. And earlier I spoke to FSN's Gary Alfonso in Yola, eastern Nigeria, and asked him about the recent unrest.
There's been about three very violent and very brutal attacks by Boko Haram militants in the north of Nigeria, particularly at Mutagari, which is a town around about 50 miles from the border with Niger. And many believe that the insurgents actually travel from Niger into the northern Nigerian states and attack people indiscriminately. And there seems to be no pattern or specific method in the attacks, rather than they are directed at people that are in Nigeria, are living in a fairly peaceful northern part of Nigeria where the Islamic faith and the Christian faith live side by side and have been doing so for the past 20 years without any internal issues. But there seems to be very extreme militant forces coming across the border and attacking people. And in the latest incident, up to 19 people were brutally killed and their throats slit at a roadblock. And obviously the Nigerian authorities and the Nigerian army are very well deployed in those parts, particularly in Borno State, in the northeastern parts of Nigeria, where they've in the last 48 hours have cornered and attacked a cell living in a very remote area near that part of the border with Niger, and have reportedly killed up to 80 of these so-called insurgents or attackers. So the battle for that part of the world is truly, something very brutal and not something Nigerians have seen for a very long time.
And can you actually just give us some background on this extremist group?
Well, the extremist group are reportedly from a group called Boko Haram, which is, as with the extreme group in Somalia, stand for Absolute Sharia Law. And that absolute Sharia law is not something that any of the northern Nigerian states subscribe to, although very strict Muslim and Islamic beliefs live side by side in, and very peacefully so, in those northern territories or the northern provinces and states of Nigeria. This Boko Haram group are moving across the borders from within northern Cameroon and also southern Niger, and are seemingly plotting attacks against fairly peaceful societies within the northern parts of Nigeria and the northern provinces, and attacking indiscriminately. So it's basically seemingly a plot by an Al-Qaeda-supported group called Boko Haram, which some of the national political figures in Nigeria believe that there could be some internal support for Boko Haram, because there are, of course, and have been for many years, some conflict between northern and southern states in Nigeria.
How do you think that these clashes, these violent clashes between the government and Boko Haram, could impact next year's election in Nigeria?
There's a school of thought here in Nigeria that the Boko Haram attacks might be taking place, and the increase is basically aimed at pressuring some of the northern states to have a more fundamental position when it comes to the political future of Nigeria. There's definitely an undertone of some political influence or some in the religious environment in between northern and southern Nigeria.
FSN's Gary Alfonso in Nigeria. Now, what happens when you give a giant empty warehouse over to the community and let them turn it into whatever they want? That's the question a social experiment called Free Space has aimed to answer. The project is in the heart of San Francisco, brought together artists, tech workers, activists and students over the course of 5 months. Now the organisers are planting the seeds of free collaboration in cities across the US and beyond. Rebecca Bowring reports.
Artist Michael Covington is putting the finishing touches to his mural, a geometric design of pastel colours and black lines. He's the art curator of Free Space, a 14,000-foot warehouse temporarily transformed into a pop-up community centre. Whether for work or for play, no one has to pay a cent to come here. Michael, a former chef who hails from Athens, Greece, says Free Space is a source of inspiration and collaboration.
People that weren't even interested in the arts or being part of a social community or anything like that, this place made it happen for them. And it made me feel empowered. It made me feel confident about how I push my art through a space like this, and pretty much making people feel happy.
He and his fellow artists have turned the white walls of the warehouse into mosaics of colour, both inside and out. But free space is more than a canvas. It also hosts events, free yoga classes, workshops, and hackathons. The venture began in June when a group of entrepreneurs secured a month's lease on the building for $1. Alana Lipset is a consultant with the Northern California Community Loan Fund, which provides loans to nonprofits. And she's one of the eight minds behind the project.
We turned it over to the community as a big experiment to see what would happen when people had space and permission to be creative, to be innovative, to build community. And our intention was just to be here for the month, but the response was so overwhelmingly positive that we decided to keep it going.
They raised money for four more months of operations through crowdfunding website Indiegogo and a private donor. In San Francisco, where tech employees are often criticized for failing to engage with the city, the experimental center goes against the grain. Startup founders, students, the homeless, the young and the old work side by side. This project echoes the free economy movement that dates back to the 1960s, when the Diggers, a left-wing group of improvisational actors, opened shops that gave away their stock and organized everything from transport to gigs for free. As with all good things, this free space must come to an end, but Alana Lipset says it's only the beginning.
We are giving the space back to the owner, concluding this very successful experiment that's been running for 5 months, and we are being offered free buildings all over the city, all over the Bay Area. We're being approached by people all over the world who want to open a free space.
The organizers are excited to be exporting the concept to other places as far afield as Detroit, Bristol, Paris, and even Singapore. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
The World Islamic Economic Forum has drawn to a close in London. This was the first time in its 9-year history that the event was held outside a Muslim country. Part of the purpose of holding the forum in the UK was to strengthen business ties between the Islamic and Western world. But as with past years, leaders from Islamic countries addressed challenges faced by the region. Our UK correspondent Natalie Feary was at the event.
At the 9th World Islamic Economic Forum, British Prime Minister David Cameron gave a warm welcome to leaders from countries including Malaysia, Afghanistan, Iraq and Pakistan, and to Islamic investment.
Investing in London is good for you, and opening London up to your investment is good for us. So the Treasury is working on the practicalities of issuing a bond-like Sukuk worth around £200 million.
Some of London's biggest developments have already received investment from funds that meet Islamic requirements. And Battersea Power Station, in the southwest of the capital, is set to undergo a $12 billion redevelopment by its Malaysian owners. With Islamic investments expected to reach the equivalent of over $2 trillion by 2014, Britain is keen to continue to tap into the growing pool of funds. But when it comes to foreign investment into Britain, the US and Europe are still far more dominant, so it could be a while yet before the UK becomes a truly Islamic financial centre. The Treasury's new Sukuk bond will be worth less than 2% of the money the government borrowed just in the month of September. And Islamic finance experts say a bigger number of infrastructure investments need to be Sharia compliant. Islamic bonds, known as Sukuks, are structured on the exchange of ownership of products or services, as Islamic investors cannot receive interest. But by deciding to hold the event in London, the Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak was also keen to show that Islamic investors are attractive business partners, particularly because of the importance placed on investing ethically.
The Muslim world can contribute positively to the well-being of the global community, and we stand ready to cooperate with the Western world and with other parts of the world as well.
The purpose of the forum was also for Islamic countries to address their challenges, such as the barriers to more women being involved in the Islamic corporate world. Here's Azmi Zahir, head of wealth management at the Sharia-compliant Gatehouse Bank.
Women made $13 trillion last year. So corporations have to take notice. They have to be inclusive and make it conducive for both men and women.
As well as the need for more inward investment to promote economic growth and prosperity, as pointed out by Afghan President Hamid Karzai.
We need to invest in our human capital, which is central to our development and progress. Above all, we need to strengthen our state institutions so that they are more accountable and responsive to the expectations and needs of our people.
Muslim leaders at the forum were all too aware of the unrest in many of their nations, and that despite Islamic countries making up close to a quarter of the world's population, they still only contribute 8% of the world's economic growth. Natalie Feary, London.
And finally tonight, tens of thousands of runners from around the world will participate in Sunday's New York City Marathon. Fear of a repeat of the deadly attacks at the Boston Marathon earlier this year has inspired drastic security changes for spectators. But onlookers will also see an inspiring story of a group of Haitian marathon competitors running in support of their troubled country. Quinn Bowman reports from New York.
A group of five runners from the island of Haiti landed for the first time in the United States just days before competing in one of the biggest races of their lives. Training in New York's Central Park fresh off the plane, they're not distracted by the huge city, the people in every direction. This is runner Petru Cezron speaking through a translator.
I feel confident coming into this competition. I'm already used to participating in marathon competitions, so I remain focused, calm, and relaxed.
He and his teammates are sponsored by the JP Haiti Relief Organization. It's a charity founded by actor Sean Penn. The organization focuses on helping Haitians living in tent camps transition to more permanent and secure housing. It also provides education and medical services to thousands still displaced by the 2010 earthquake. JPHRO has already raised tens of thousands of dollars in donations to support the runners and their mission. One of the camps managed by the organization once held 60,000 Haitians, but since then 75% have now transitioned into new homes. 31-year-old Bertine Lane says she wants to see a better life for her fellow Haitians.
I would like to get children off the streets by providing them with quality education and engaging them in sport activities. I would also like to see better care facilities for people with physical disabilities, because I believe until you are dead, there is still something to live for. Life goes on. I know that for a lot of people with physical disabilities in our society, they often face many challenges and lose hope. To me, they remain important members of society and should be embraced and better supported by the community.
The Haitian team will compete in a swollen field of 48,000 in the marathon. Two aspects of this year's race make it special. Hurricane Sandy devastated the city before the race last year, prompting organizers to cancel at the last moment. And it is the most high-profile American race held since the bombings that killed and maimed runners at Boston's marathon earlier this year. Race officials say they've doubled their spending on security to $1 million. Authorities will search bags brought anywhere near the finish line. Police video cameras will watch the 26.2-mile race route, in addition to an army of police officers. Runners will be limited in what types of containers and bags they can bring to the start line. The counterterrorism operation to protect the marathon route will be one of the largest in New York's history. Runners racing across the five boroughs for the first time in 2 years will see bomb-sniffing dogs and police boats watching alongside the fans. The attacks in Boston showing a lasting effect beyond the dead and injured. Quinn Bowman, New York.
And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. Remember, you can tell us what you think of our programme by emailing us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there, @FeatureStory. FSN Reports returns on Monday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Rebecca Foster. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.